Well,
what's up, man? Hey, how are you this week?
Everything's good.
We did the countdown correctly this time, so I'm very excited about that. So.
Hey, man, I guarantee you it gets easier every time.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but more, I'll still forget the count.
No more premature commentating. So, how was your week, man?
My week was pretty good. You know, I was reminded of why I'm happier not have chosen the law as a profession.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Got a ticket, yeah?
I didn't get a ticket, but my wife did. But, you know, I was quickly reminded by the city prosecutor, whose name I have forgotten.
Yeah.
Because of his insignificance.
That seems accurate. I like it. We had an exciting week around here. Jonathan was in town. We did a couple of interviews and talks with him, and he was checking out our information, flew all the way in from the Philippines. So it's been kind of an exciting week having him here.
Yeah, he had a long flight. Came over yesterday, saw what we were doing. And
yeah, he's got a longer flight back. He has to do a 11-hour layover in Tokyo, which I think there's worse places for a layover. But
I would agree with that.
If you had 11 hours in Tokyo, what would you do? Go just stuff with sushi and have a few beers?
Yeah, I think I would go out and explore for sure.
Yeah.
And I would just, you know, probably do some research before I ventured out just to make sure of being able to get back in time, you know, but I think I'd be okay.
Fair enough, man. I'm Scott Hess, tax and business consultant.
I'm John Barton, small business owner. Remember the tortoise and the hare? Slow and steady wins the race.
We started Turtlesmith to help people start small businesses, providing information and resources to small business owners and entrepreneurs.
Build a solid foundation and forge your dreams.
Well, you just want to get into our first segment?
Yeah, we can jump right in.
Talking about step four of phase one, which is the feasibility study. And the end goal of this one is just yes or no, is this business possible? So there's a few things that we have to look at. And really what you want to do is maybe talk to some people in your life about the business idea, or discuss it with some people who are in the same kind of similar business. Give them your elevator pitch and let them poke holes in it. That's a real good starting point. This should not be a discouragement if people are poking holes in it. It should be just a way to learn and try to have good answers to those holes that get poked in it. And I always like to talk to people who are a little bit of naysayers. You know, there's some grumpy people in my life who are always poking holes in things. And if ever I have a good business idea, I kind of run it by them, and it helps me with that initial feasibility.
Oh, so you love Don as much as I do.
There you go. Yeah. You know, it's good to have those kind of naysayers in your life, not to not do the business, but to just what other people think about it. So in this step, it's really important that you just think about quick math and do some research. So you don't need to get too far into the weeds on a financial analysis or do anything crazy. We just want to do some quick math to see if it's possible that this thing would work out. And so few steps to kind of get down into the information that you're going to need. You have your elevator pitch, so you've sort of narrowed your focus. You're an expert in your industry, and you've determined your market size. So the first thing to talk about is customers. So you know your market. Can you effectively reach your market? And what kind of advertising or marketing might go into that step, you know, of finding those customers? For me, it was a simple matter of just cold calling businesses, emailing businesses, trying to network in types of deals. Your business a little bit different. You probably had a whole, well, I don't know. Did you have a whole marketing strategy when you came on, or?
We had no marketing strategy. Yeah. I mean, I guess my marketing strategy would be considered maybe guerrilla marketing on the forums, you know, just going on and everywhere I could inject anything about my cases that I thought was relevant to the topic. You know, mm-hmm. I really did try not to spam anybody or, you know, be one of those people that's just always hanging around handing their business card, you know, to you at every moment. But I tried to be a member of the communities to speak on other topics to help people out. Ended up getting in a lot of arguments, but at the bottom of every post was my signature with the JB cases.
Yeah.
So, you know, slowly we started building clientele. But that was it. That was the marketing.
You went to a lot of shows too at the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of trade shows, and mm-hmm. you sold at those deals. So in this kind of feasibility, it's good to think about how much those might cost, the travel expenses and stuff, you know, hotels if you have to, or just, you know, sleeping in your van if you have to.
Listen, there's
figured out. Yeah.
There's been times where we've gone to those shows and I have literally not had enough money to stay at them.
Yeah.
And we depended on sales on the first day to be able to pay the bills on the third day.
That's just ballsy.
You know,
ballsy to take that or believe in yourself enough that you're going to be able to make those sales to survive. So
yeah, but sometimes when the alternative is not surviving either, even if you don't go, then you take that shot. But you know, it would be better. You know, those were a lot of painful years. You know, and a lot of years when I didn't know if we'd make it or not, and I didn't know if we'd, you know, have to let people go. And I think, you know, that the people that are successful in those situations, that's great, but they gave up a lot of blood and a lot of sacrifice that didn't have to be made.
Yeah.
You know. If they had just simply had people in their life like we're trying to be for other people's lives.
Right. Yeah, well, hopefully this makes it all easier. But anyway, so the first thing you're going to be doing is customers, analyzing that, how you're going to get in front of them, what your marketing strategy, and maybe what those kind of things would cost. The second big factor to think about is vendors, especially if you have supplies that you need to make your product or suppliers that you're going to have to deal with on a regular basis. And this is kind of the first time we'll talk about the negotiating power of you as a buyer. You know, some companies, especially large companies, have a lot of negotiating power because they have big contracts and a lot of money to spend. Small businesses don't necessarily have that kind of buying power, but if there's a lot of potential suppliers out there, then they have a lot of bargaining power. And so they can just switch to whoever has the cheapest stuff. But it's really important to think about, is there one supplier for your good in the whole country? And will they be able to supply you with enough of your product? So this is the time when you need to go out and get those sheets, you know, price sheets, lists, figure out how much everything's going to cost to put your stuff together. If you just need like software and stuff, get those quotes. You know, most websites have, you know, what the software is going to cost per year, and hit those forums and ask other people, you know, what they're paying for stuff. So verifying your suppliers and whether they can fulfill all of your needs and how much it's going to cost is important in that step.
You know, this sounds like work because it is work. What Scott is explaining to you, you know, what did you say? This is the fourth lesson in the...
This is our fourth step in many steps of phase one.
All right. So. All right. So did you hear that? This is the fourth step in phase one. I'm already asleep before he finishes the word phase one.
But well, I hope not. But...
Well, I'm going to tell you guys something, right? And this is real, is if I had taken the time, you know, and been as smart as I think I am and done something like this at the beginning, then there's a good likelihood that Scott wouldn't even be my accountant right now. You know, my accountants would be in suits and shit and have limos of their own.
But you don't like how I dress? I need to wear a suit.
I love how you dress. I love how you dress, and I'm glad that I ended up here. The point being, though, as you well know, right, is that with the proper planning, with the work that comes before you even get to really start your business, you know, that's what you're investing into your business. That's the time. And the more time that you invest into it that way, the better your outcome is going to be.
100%.
Regardless of what business you're in.
100%.
You can overcome a lot of economic stuff. You can overcome a lot of, you know, whatever laws people are passing and things like that, you know, that don't directly affect you, but they might affect the larger society. But you can overcome a lot of that if you've built a solid foundation and your product, you know, is worth it.
100%. Well, after customers and vendors, then you need to start looking at what your startup costs are going to be, specifically like any big equipment that you need to purchase, any, you know, supplies that you need on demand before you start. So this is where you'll do kind of a quick startup cost analysis. And there is no problem before you start your business to get out there and get quotes and estimates from people. A lot of vendors are more than happy to provide, you know, not only the quote for the price, but how long it'll take to get you that piece of specialized equipment you need for your business. It may be as simple as just a computer and a desk, but you should definitely take the time to figure out, okay, what softwares do I need to buy? What kind of computer do I need with the certain specs and how much that's going to cost?
Some vendors are willing to give you favorable terms. They're willing to give you
financing options.
Financing options. Yeah. They're willing to give you advice. They're willing to send people to train you.
Absolutely.
They're willing to bring you to them to be trained.
Yeah, making those phone calls, it can seem scary in this stage, but it really is important to be doing it now, finding these things out.
When I did my first company, I found myself at a big supplier of vinyl material.
Mm-hmm.
You know, older generations here would call it Naugahyde. You know,
yeah.
Leatherette, that sort of stuff. But anyway, this company is Hornschuk in Germany, and they were, at that time, as far as my knowledge was, is Europe's, you know, largest supplier of this material. So if you found it on cars and things like that, it would be from them. But what I had to do was convince them to sell me 1 meter of each of their colors and textures, as opposed to a roll, which was their minimum. Normally.
Right.
The rolls had like 500 meters on it.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, you know, sat down with them. Talk to them, explain what we were doing, you know. And for me, my girlfriend at the time, you know, she was like, don't go in there. You can't talk to the people in that office and stuff like that. You know, very German.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I only know one thing, right? And that is, if I don't try, then the answer is still no.
Right.
You know, that's the only thing I can do. I can try. They say no, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if you get to know your vendors, right, you get to know the people, you tell them kind of where you're at, what you're doing, what your goals are, and you have all this, right? You have your elevator pitch, you have, you know, your planning and your feasibility up to this point and so on. You've got as much knowledge, you're an expert, right? That can be really impressive to folks like that. You know, they're eager to help you. You know, especially a lot of these vendors, they want a new customer.
That's a key point to mention, too. We've harped on that a couple times. Even these big companies are excited to have a new vendor, even if you're not maybe their typical customer or their typical size, like you were talking about. I think people will be very surprised how often people are just willing to help. You know, they want to see you succeed just as much as you want to succeed.
Well, I guess it could be the opposite of shit rolls downhill,
yeah.
Right? Success spreads uphill, I guess, or something.
And there you go.
You know, so people that are responsible for you in that big corporation, you're their account, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then their department has a head and so on, right? So the better you do, the better their boss thinks they do, the better their department leader thinks they do, and so on. So it all plays a role, you know, in that. And most of the time, I think that getting to know your vendors is going to prove that they want to work with you. You know,
right.
As long as they know you know your shit. Now, if you get on there and you try to bullshit a vendor, they're going to smell that immediately because they've seen it all.
Right.
And it's super important to recognize that as a newbie in the field, even if you've become an expert on paper in this, you know, you can probably quote the manuals back to these guys better than they know them. They still know that you have no experience.
Right.
So they know, you know, when you talk about your capabilities or whatever, they know when you're not being truthful about that, you know, when you're overstating your position, and they know full well that you're not going to be ordering 5 rolls at a time from them, you know, inside of a year. Like you say you're going to.
You know,
they may see that as a goal, you know, or a wish, but they know because they've seen it all. They've seen every new vendor that there is, capitalized, undercapitalized, you know, from every walk of life. They've seen it.
Yeah, they know. So they know your business.
Know your shit. and then be truthful with them, and you're going to find that a lot of these guys will just go out of their way to help you. They'll practically adopt you.
100%. 100%. Well, after that, the vendors and equipment, you want to look into the legal and regulatory landscape of your business. Now, you should have already kind of become an expert, but really now it's the time to look at some of these licenses or permits that your business may need and what you need to get them. So do you have to have certain education requirements? You know, to be a CPA, you have to have so many hours to take the test. To be a lawyer, you have to pass the bar. Engineers have to do certain things. Now, that's only very specific professional deals, but some permits like real estate and those kind of things require at least a class or two. So this is where we're going to look at kind of the legal and regulatory stuff, and can you overcome those legal hurdles? Can you get everything that you need to start your business? And if you can, and you've passed kind of all the customers, vendors, equipment, and legal and regulatory stuff, now we want to take a look at time. Time is something that a lot of young entrepreneurs or people first getting into business don't think about very much. And you should really start thinking about how long does it take you to successfully complete a project that you're going to be working on. If you're providing a service, how long does it take to complete a certain service for your clients? Or if you're making a good, how long does it take to put it together?
So I'll jump in with a story on this. So if you're a custom maker like I am, then people come to you because they have ideas of things that express themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the broader your choices are, the more that they're going to take up your time with those choices, and they're going to be unsure. A lot of them, not all of them. Some of them are pretty certain by the time they get to you. But the ones that take up most of the time are the ones that want to talk endlessly about everything.
Yeah.
At this point, they haven't even purchased anything from you, but they wanted your time is of no value to them. They can spend it endlessly. So, and this is one of the things that new entrepreneurs don't factor in. Even people, and I've seen this, even people who come from a profession, and they decide they're going to open up, they're going to hang out their own shingle in that profession. And I'm not talking about an attorney or an accountant. You know, I'm speaking of people who mow lawns. You know, you're working for a guy, now you're the guy, right?
Right.
But now you're the guy, and now before you were the one that was told, go to this address, be there at this time, this lawn should take you 2 hours, after that go to this address, and, you know, that's your day every day.
You're right.
Well, one day you want to be the guy that's telling the guys where to go.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, now that comes with a whole other set of issues, you know, and a whole other person and family you got to factor into each one of these jobs.
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily your profit. And the more hours that you got to spend with Mr. Jones talking about the exact height of his edging, right?
Right.
Lowers your profit on that job.
Yeah.
And the other jobs that you're not able to devote your time to.
Right. Yeah. That's the killer.
You know? And so that's why this step here, number 5, is so freaking important. Up to this point, I still haven't told my story.
Oh, okay.
So there was a promising kid. I've told this before on one of these podcasts, but you're going to hear these stories over and over as I feel they're relevant. There was a promising young new casemaker. This guy had plenty of ideas. He seemed very creative, and he jumped right in making custom leather cases for $250. Now, a lot of you might not know the prices of cases or the prices of fine leather goods or good leather stuff, but $250 for a leather pool cue case is very cheap. And this kid was good. Like an artist, you know, he had a really creative brain. The designs he came up with were fantastic and so on. But he hand drew them, you know. They weren't like computer generated or anything like
right.
that. So very, very quickly, he filled up his order book, you know. He got lots and lots of people paying him $250 in advance. So he goes out, he buys a ton of leather, he buys a ton of equipment. And he keeps getting phone calls from the people who ordered the cases and people who want to order cases. And every single one of those people wants to talk about their order. They want to make changes, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were just wondering, you know, if maybe it wouldn't look better if this diamond was a little bit closer to this center and so on, right?
Yep.
So you can see where this is going, right? Kid spends all of his money, got lots of leather, lots of equipment. The phone never stops ringing. And his production, you know, goes to near zero in comparison to the amount of orders that he took.
Yeah.
And pretty soon he's being vilified and people are, you know, I mean, this kid's probably never heard himself called so many shitty names in his life.
Yep.
And so, you know, long story short on this, guy goes out of business. He disappears. You know, everybody's money's gone except for the few people who got cases. And that's it. I think I bailed three customers out.
Yeah. On this, you know? One of those cases he made were probably great, but he didn't pay attention to his time.
Well, the thing is they weren't yet great structurally.
Oh, fair enough.
But they were decent, and they would have improved, you know. Had he taken the time, for example, to do this work, but even before that, had he taken the time to go back here to the feasibility and talk to other case makers like me.
Yeah, now if he would have come to you and said, I'm going to make this for $250, what would you have said? You're crazy?
I'd have said, some people fall for get-rich-quick schemes.
Mm-hmm.
You're falling for a get-broke-quick scheme.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's what I would have told him, but I would have explained it to him the same way, right?
Yeah.
That's why we have a team.
Right. You got to have people to answer
to do
your
this.
Phones.
I don't take orders.
Yeah.
You know?
Crazy.
I don't. At the very beginning, I took the orders. Yes, I did. And my ability to grow, my ability to feed myself, you know, was in jeopardy because of the fact that I couldn't simultaneously take a lot of orders and also build the product and also pack and ship it and also follow up and make sure the customer's good with it and also market and also go to a show and also take more orders and so on.
Right.
So don't underestimate number five here, right? Because not understanding the amount that you really truly need to charge, that you must charge, not that you want to charge, not a price that you yourself necessarily feel comfortable paying, you know, because there's very few of us that are actually, you know, able to go through the supermarket and not care about the prices. You know, most people in this country, I would think, you know, are kind of feeling it when they fill up their grocery basket.
Yeah, the pricing we talk about here in just a little bit, this is more just your time involved. You want to kind of study about how much time does it take you to complete the
right.
task.
Right, it's very important to be realistic here.
Absolutely, you and know, always so. Overestimate as well. Yeah. So the next portion here with these next few steps is where we do get into some math, and this is where your eyes might glaze over a little bit. But the next step we want to talk about is we want to ballpark our fixed and our variable expenses. And I just want to define those very quickly. The fixed expenses are what's also called maybe your monthly cash burn. And it's just the amount of money it takes to keep the lights on, having made no revenue or interacted with any customers. So your rent, your utilities, your fixed administrative costs, things like that. So this is not factoring in the cost that it does to provide the service or to make a product. It's just to keep the lights on. It's also called your overhead sometimes as well. So what you want to do, Excel is going to be your best friend here. Just kind of line item out, you know, how much is my rent? How much is my utilities? How much is all of these things?
Yeah, we're going to have resources available for people.
We will. We're going to hopefully have some great forms on there that you'll be able to download. There's also a lot of great ones on Google. You know, turtlesmith.com will continuously update as we go forward with some of these great softwares and programs to help us out to make these calculations a little easier. But, you know, I've been doing this business for a long time, and Excel is just the best thing in the world for these kind of calculations. And variable expenses is the other part of this. Now, variable expenses is your cost of goods sold, your expenses directly tied to your product. So if I sell t-shirts, for $20. I buy them for $10. It costs me a dollar for the designs and maybe another dollar for the packaging. My variable cost per item would be $12. And so that's an important number to figure out, both your fixed costs and your variable expenses. And again, we're just doing quick math here. So, you know, just try to run through those costs. Use what you've done in the previous steps here. You're looking at vendors, looking at equipment to kind of come up with those overall costs. And then in the next portion, we want to do the revenue projections. This is where we talked about pricing. Pricing is very, very difficult. It's one of the hardest things that you can do and to come up with that perfect price for things to attract enough customers, but also not to shoot yourself in the foot. You know, that guy had so many great sales from the store you were talking about because he was only at $250. Had he had his price at, say, $1,000, maybe he wouldn't have had enough customers, but or maybe he would have, people would have just said he was crazy because it was too high. I don't know. So really what you want to do is talk to people in the industry, talk to people like you. You know, he should have come to you and said, this is kind of what I'm trying to do. Any idea what you think I could charge for such a kind of premium product? But you can look at your competitors, relevant, you know, data online, look up what other accountants cost, and do not be afraid to call people. When I started out, I called other bookkeeping services and asked them how much it was for like a monthly bookkeeping service and monthly payroll. And I called about 20 of them. Some wouldn't tell me over the phone, but a lot told me over the phone. And I was able to get a good estimate of what I could charge, a comparable rate.
You can get a lot of good data if you just simply go looking for it.
Yeah. And that may be a little underhanded tactic to call your competitors, but too bad.
Here's a question for you. If someone were to call you, mm-hmm. Would they be able to get a monthly rate?
100%. Now, if somebody called me and said, hey, I'm a competitor, how much could I charge or how much do you charge? I probably wouldn't tell them. But
you wouldn't?
I probably would. But in my earlier years, I probably wouldn't have, especially when I was still trying to build my business. But if they called now, I'd probably just tell them. I'd give them a little helpful hand. In fact, I've done so on Reddit and stuff when I've talked to people. I think more often – I think I for sure had at least a few phone calls where people have said, hey, I'm starting a restaurant. What do you charge for bookkeeping? And then I never hear from them again. And I always wondered if that was maybe somebody else trying to start another business. So, well, I mean, your prices are mostly online, so you could easily find out what you're charging for cases when you can go online and hunt down your competitors and find out their prices as well. So this is where we want to kind of take a look at what we could be able to charge. And then we want to look at our time. The time is really important. How much could we be at max capacity? And capacity is another good thing to think about. When you start out, you might be only at doing 10% of your total amount, and then you'll slowly grow into maybe 80 to 90%. You know, my business, I'm not quite at 100% ever. I'm usually right around 80% of what I could totally do. You're pretty well maxed out on your orders.
Yeah, we're pretty much, we make some for our own sales each mm-hmm. month, but they're less than they've ever been. And, whatever we produce in a month, we generally turn it over that month. So, so otherwise we're at full capacity on orders.
So this is where, with the projections and everything, we should have a good kind of, another term they use is like pro forma. We can start working on where we can estimate and project our revenues. And again, I think we'll have some resources on Turtle Smith for people to be able to plug those in.
I made myself a little formula. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to detail it right here, but I'll outline it for you. But basically, the formula works like this: it's whatever my cost is, mm-hmm. Then I tack on a certain markup over that. Maximum that I will allow for a discount on my mm-hmm. product, or basically what I want to earn, no matter what. Mm-hmm. And then I'll take that number, whatever it is. And that will represent 40% of the retail price.
Yeah.
And that's it. So then I can back it off to 40% if necessary.
Yeah.
And I still have the profit margin that I wanted. And then anything above that, right, is then just extra profit.
That's a good way to think about it.
That's why we do a mixture of retail sales and auctions and then wholesale sales, right? Mm-hmm. Because if I sold everything at wholesale, I would still be making the revenue, that the profit that I want to make, right? But being between like that allows a blend that's always going to be above that.
That's a good way to think about it.
The thing is with this, right, is that you have to be making profit to stay healthy, to have resources.
Correct. Yeah, revenue alone cannot survive. You have to make sure that you're making money at the end of the day.
And that's, you know, as you guys are thinking about these revenue projections, you also have to think about how much reserve am I going to be able to build in case something happens. And think of it as an insurance payment, you know, in a sense.
Yeah.
Because something is going to happen.
Yeah. Well, so it's important to remember, too, when you're thinking about your pricing, that if you are a wholesaler specifically, and this really is going to come to goods, not so much services, but on goods, if you're a wholesaler, the retailer is typically going to mark it up 100%. So if you sell something to them for $5, they're going to sell it for 10. And so you need to make sure that your wholesale price is high enough that you can overcome your fixed and variable expenses and still have a little bit at the end of the day. A quick way to think about this, especially in this feasibility study, is kind of the 25% method. So your variable costs should be 25% of your price. Your fixed cost or overhead is 25%, and then 25% goes to taxes, meaning that on every sale you make, the 25%-ish is your profit. So if it takes me, we just back that up from the variable cost. So if my product takes $5 to make, then I need to sell it for $20. So $5 is my goods. $5 goes to my overhead or fixed expenses. $5 goes to taxes, and then I get to keep $5 of every $20 sale. So that's kind of a quick method when you're selling a good to think about it.
Right. If you're selling wholesale.
Yeah, if you're selling wholesale.
Now, if you can build yourself a direct-to-consumer business.
Correct.
You're the maker. You're the supplier. You're the warehouser. You're the shipper. Then, of course, you can do one of two things. You can sell it for the same retail that you would sell it to if you had extra links in the chain, have that much more profit. However, what you invite there is you invite competition to come in at a lower price.
Yes.
So you can have very high profit for a while. Or you can lower the price. You still make the same profit or more even, you know, instead of selling it for $20, you sell it for $13.99.
Yeah, your margins are way better on retail or direct to consumer. But something to think about, though, is that in the wholesale side of things, usually your volume is much bigger. And so you may end up making more money selling higher volume at a lower cost, or you might be able to make more money selling at a higher markup, but just, you know, lower volume. So
now I'm going to
this
tell
is
you,
where you play the kind of pricing game, and it becomes very difficult. But in this kind of feasibility step, you just want to come up with a general ballpark of what you're going to charge.
So I'm going to tell you one more story real quick.
Yeah, feel free.
I promise this one will be quick.
Fair.
There was a particular machine that I wanted to buy. I didn't have enough money to buy it. So I went to my customer and I asked him if he would loan it to me.
Yeah.
Instead of loaning it to me, he puts in an order and then gives me all the money for the order in advance. And then of that, I can take the money that I need for the machine. And great, I'm happy, right? I get the machine. Actually, it didn't turn out to be the right machine, but that's another story. But now I have to start making the product for this guy. It takes us 6 months to make this product.
Yeah.
At the end of the 6 months, we sat down and tried to figure out what we had left over just for us that we made as what we call pure profit. We had $5,000 for 6 months of work. Our shop working all the time, us working all the time. You know, at the end of it, we had $5,000. And in that 6 months, though, I couldn't do any work for anybody else.
Yeah, that was it.
You know, I couldn't take any orders. I had to tell people that we'd start taking orders, you know, in, let's say, July, right? From January to July. And that was it. So this is why it's so important right here to understand how much it's going to take to really break even and what it will take to be ahead of that. And there's a calculator out there that I want, Calvin, make sure that we mark this point. There's a calculator out there that I want to tell you all about, and we're going to try and find the link to it. But meanwhile, you guys can look for it. The calculator is when I give a discount of X, right? 5%, 10%, whatever, right? How many more units of my good do I need to sell to account for that discount that I gave? Profit that you end up with, that you're left over with.
Yeah. And the number is usually surprising.
Yes, it is. It actually is. It's very sobering is what it is, because people think, and I thought, I got discounts, man. I can play with my discounts. I can, you know, here's friend and family over here. I like you, dealer. You know, I'm going to put you at 40%. You just have to buy two cases a year.
Right.
You know, you over here, you're going to get 30%. You got to buy 20 cases a year. You know what I mean? It's just like you're doing all this and you're not looking at the bottom line, because you're not, you don't understand how these numbers work, you know, and how many more units you have to make it up. So I'm existing, right? I'm existing. Payroll's getting made. Some months is a little tight. Some months is not. I'm existing. I'm having experiences, right? I get to go to shows. I get to you know, hang out with these pros, those pros, and so on. But am I building anything solid, you know? Like, if I'd have stayed on the path I was on, I don't know that I could have put my kids through college. We'd be selling cases, you know, but we'd be juggling the bills just to pay their tuition.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned break-even, and that's actually the next portion of this is the break-even analysis. And it's the first time we're going to talk about using an actual equation. So we'll make sure to have this up as a graphic, hopefully, and then we will get the links for how to calculate it. But the break-even equation is basically your fixed costs over your profit margin. And the profit margin is revenue per unit minus variable costs per unit. And so it is fixed costs divided, and then in little parentheses, revenue minus variable costs. And you, this determines how many units you have to sell in order to break even. And so if my fixed costs are like $1,000, my revenue is per unit 10, and then I have $5 in variable costs, I take that 10 minus 5, which is $5, and then I'm going to take my $1,000 of fixed costs and divide it by my profit of 5, which means I have to sell 200 units to make exactly $0. That's how I break even. So anything over $200, I'm now profitable. But if I'm under 200 units, then I'm losing money every month.
But say you got your 201st unit.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that is your actual profit?
No. So it's not per unit, not $200 per unit. These are just in units that we're talking about.
No, here. I understand that it's not 200 per unit.
Yeah. Okay, what are you asking then? I'm sorry.
I'm saying based on the formula that you just put on here, right? Mm-hmm. How much of that one extra unit would be left over as profit? In other words, how much do I make?
So in the break-even point, until you sell enough units to break even, right, your profit is zero.
Right. So that's 200. And so then now you got 201.
Well, then you just do the equation there and you can figure it out, but it's probably $5.
Right. So but it's a $20 sell or $10 to a wholesaler.
Right.
But your profit on that one unit at that moment is $5.
Yeah,
so how long did it take you to make those other 200 units?
Right.
So our the way I would look at it is I can make 200 units in 2 weeks.
Right.
And then I can make another 200 in the next 2 weeks, and then every one of those will be profitable for me.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is, again, you just want to look at your price and then those variable and fixed costs, but then also most importantly, your time. What kind of your capacity is it going to take to break even? So if your capacity is like you said, 2 weeks to build 200 units, that's about a 50% capacity just to break even. And then you have the remaining 2 weeks of building for your profit. That's maybe not a great model, so you need to kind of reevaluate some of these numbers. You want to be breaking even by maybe only using 15 to 20% of your time. Otherwise, you would not be able to make enough profit to survive on. Now, that is very dependent on the kind of good you're doing and how expensive it is. Very big difference in how many units you need to sell if you're selling something for $5 versus $5,000.
You know, as always here, it's super important to be conservative with these numbers.
Very good point.
And I can tell you this from experience. You know, if you go into my computer, you'll find a lot of old spreadsheets that I played around with and stuff like that. And what you will find on there, on some of them, is you will find some fanciful numbers. You'll find numbers that you know, we talked before on another podcast about, you know, all the people that come to me with ideas and say, if only I could get, you know, 1% of this market share, yeah, you know, then we'll be rich beyond belief and mm-hmm. so on. Well, you know, I can just say from my own experience, I'm not immune to fantasizing, you know, I'm not immune to tweaking a few numbers here and there and making that bottom line look really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's my version of if only.
Right.
Right. So it's very, very important to be, you know, you can play that game, but when you really get down to business about whether or not you're actually going to do this business, it's super important to be hyper realistic about it, to be even pessimistic a little bit in the numbers, you know, very conservative.
It's a very good point. Absolutely. Yeah. Conservatism, being conservative is going to be your friend.
There's a maxim in business, you know, and it's real simple. It's basically just under promise and over deliver.
Yep.
You know, if you can get somebody their service quicker, they're happy. You can get them their product quicker, they're happy. If you can make it quicker and better, they're happier, right? Mm-hmm. But the moment you're late, then no matter how perfect it is, they're looking for flaws.
Yep.
So you see how that changes that dynamic in one instant. If you're 1 minute late, now they're looking for flaws.
Absolutely. And so the last portion or kind of step in this feasibility study is to do kind of some year-over-year projections. And again, this is where Excel is going to kind of be your friend. We'll hopefully have some great materials for you to use on Turtlesmith. You know, check that out. That should be all up there for you. But what you want to do is you want to be realistic in the number of customers you can get, how much supply you can afford, how much equipment you'll be able to have, and then how much time and everything you'll be able to do as you build up your business. So it is very unrealistic to say for most businesses that they will break even any time in the first year. It's just a common thing to not be able to break even in your first year. Most businesses, depending on your industry, can take anywhere from a year to 2 years to actually break through that break even.
What are some reasons for that?
You know, it's really just about building up customers, figuring out your management and managing your money. It also takes a lot of money usually to get started in certain industries. Jumping into things, you're not, like for you, you probably didn't sell at your maximum capacity for the first several years of your business. You know, you had to get your word out there. The amount of cases that you were selling on day one is very different from what you're selling mm-hmm. now. And that's just in general business. Now, for my service company, I broke even pretty quickly. You know, I was able to probably in my second month have enough clients to pay most of my company bills, but I wasn't living very well. I was making pretty low amount of money. So I was breaking even quickly because I didn't have very many costs. But for most businesses that sell a product, it takes a while to get to that point.
So should they ask themselves as a preliminary question, you know, how long do I expect it to take before I break even? How long do I expect it to take before I make a profit?
Yes. And that's part of this year over year projections. You right want to now, do about a four or five, up to about 5 years is usually what I recommend.
So the reason that I ask about whether they should ask themselves that question is psychological preparation.
Yes.
Because I, you know, this goes back to my previous point about being conservative in your numbers, right, is also being conservative in your expectations.
Yeah, realistic expectations because are very important.
Without the knowledge that, you're acquiring here, and once again, I just refer to myself, it becomes very easy to indulge in a lot of what ifs and a lot of fantasies. It becomes very easy to let the first, you know, halfway decent success be extrapolated to a much greater success that is undeserved and would take a lot longer to get to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to fall into traps, you know, where you become beholden to your vendors and to your customers. You know, if you've taken on big wholesale accounts that are a lot of money, but there's not a lot of money left over. So this is one reason why you start to look at this stuff, you know, and you really try to suss out conservatively as much as you can your year-on-year projections. And if you do it the right way, right, everything goes okay, you'll find yourself with a big surplus of money that now you have to figure out what to do with, that you can invest, you can buy those machines, you can, you know, finance that expansion or put it into other instruments that do whatever you need it to do.
Yeah, very true. So at this point, you should just have, like I said at the beginning, some quick math, some basic numbers. Later steps when, John, your eyes will really glaze over in some of these final steps when we do financial talks. And we'll get more nitty-gritty into the actual numbers. We'll show how to do actual pro formas and actual full-on projections for everything that you can do. These are, again, just quick and dirty numbers on the vendors and equipment and stuff that you're going to need to try to make sure that this business is feasible. So when you look at all of the things that you've learned in this step, what you want to do is you want to take a hard look at it and you want to say, is everything I've done here reasonable? And if so, am I happy with where I think this could go? So are my initial projections based on just this limited information looking like a success? Is it going to make enough money? Am I going to be able to get enough customers? Am I going to be able to make sure I'm working well with all my suppliers and everything? And if that's the case, then you should move on to the next step. But if at this point you are still stuck, or maybe you just can't see a way to break even, or you can't see a way to work with your vendors, then it's time to maybe take a step back and reevaluate whether this plan is good or if maybe you need to take it in a different direction.
So if we were to estimate from this point right here, so to get to this point, starting from step one, how long would you say it would take? You know, I know it's hard to guess because there's so many industries and everything, but would you say someone should budget at least 2 months maybe?
I don't think it's as much time as in real world, like months, as much as just how much time you can devote to it. So I would say the elevator pitch should be an ever evolving thing, but to get a good one may take an hour to 5 or 6 hours to really think about how to narrow that focus. To become an expert in your industry is probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 hours or more. You know, you should really take some time during that step. And there may be people who are already experts, or they've already been dreaming and scheming about this, so they might have a shorter time frame in that. But 50 hours is probably good with that. You know, they say it takes 10,000 hours to become an actual expert in something, but if you really work hard at it, you should be able to know what you need in that kind of time frame. The market research, again, depending on your industry and the availability, should be anywhere between 5 and 10 hours. So before we've even made it to this step, you should have reasonably spent 60 hours just doing your homework, you know? And in this step, I think it's going to, again, really determine the availability of the information and how willing people are to give you the information. So a lot of this is going to be phone calls, reaching out to people, talking to suppliers, talking to potential customers, maybe even, and conversing with maybe your lawyers or legal resources to make sure you can overcome those legal and regulatory hurdles. I would say somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 15 hours probably on this one. So if you're kind of at the max of all of them, you're somewhere around almost 2 weeks of work, you know, full-time job just to get to step four, and we've got about another 20 steps to go.
So as I said earlier, though, all this time is really worth it. This is the you are actually pretty much the only person who can invest this time.
I am of the opinion that for every 1 hour you spend now doing these things, you will save yourself 10 hours of headache in the future and probably a lot of money.
A lot of money.
I have seen in every one of these steps that we're going through, I have seen people start businesses and fail at each of the steps that we're going to talk about. And their business has failed because they didn't pay attention to that single step.
And I will say that as I read through this, I see a lot of steps that I did wrong or didn't do at all. And I think back to what those things cost me.
Yeah. You know, and a lot of money left on
the table. And I don't mean cost me in terms of sales not made. I mean cost me in terms of wrong supplies purchased, bad deals made, you know, not understanding the finances of it and thinking that I could, you know, easily give up a lot more discount than I could. You know, there's just so many things here that had I put the thought into it at the very beginning, later on I would have been prepared to handle those situations as they come up.
Yeah. Well, any final thoughts on the feasibility study?
No, it's just that I think that, you know, people need to understand out there that this is a lot of work, but it's not the end of the world. It's what you're investing to put in here. And then one thing I want to make clear, if you go through all this and you get to this point and you've run the numbers in every which way you can think of outside of fantasy, okay? But realistically, you've run the numbers every which way. You've thought of every person you could possibly get money from. You know, you've run down every scenario and you find that this particular business as it sits at this moment is not going to work for you. Do not be afraid to move on and find something else, because the very fact that you spent the time and went through all this, let me think of who said it. Who invented the light bulb, Scott? Or who's Edison, right? Yeah. Yeah. I think there was a question Edison got about, you know, doesn't it feel bad about the, you know, 60,000 attempts you made before this? You know, and I'm obviously super paraphrasing, so feel free to correct me.
I think it was like, 10,000. And then, no, I just found out 10,000 ways how not to make a light bulb.
Right, right. It's like on the 10,001st, you know, he figured it out and that was it. But then all the 10,000 previous ones, he goes, I know 10,000 ways that don't work, as opposed to any other person. Now, this is just me talking. But as opposed to any other person who doesn't even know one way that doesn't work.
Right.
You know, and they don't even know how the way that does work actually works.
Right. Well, and going through this study and the market research and becoming an expert, you may find that your business is not good, but you might discover another avenue or some other approach or even an entirely new business venture that you never even thought about by doing all of this work. So it's all about being open to those opportunities and thinking about stuff.
Yeah, I mean, just thinking about that, I think, well, what if you spent the time to get to talk to these vendors and then one of them communicated a problem that no one has solved and you just figure out a solution and figure out a way to service those guys instead of, you know, going after
retail. And you hit the nail on the head there. Solving a problem can be a whole business in itself. So, well, I just want to reemphasize one more time on this feasibility deal. You don't want to get too far into the weeds. Quick math. Just try to get ballpark numbers to really see if it works. At a later time, we will get much further into the financials and we'll really nail down exactly what we're looking at. So, I think that's it, man.
Very cool.
Right on.
This episode is sponsored by JB Cases. JB Cases is a pool cue case company specializing in custom cases. They have been in business since 2007, and their motto is true protection, true durability, true comfort, and true custom. Visit them at jbcases.com. So, the topic that we kind of wanted to just chit-chat about this week is reliability and its importance you know, to business and life just in general.
Absolutely.
I'll tell you from my side of it as a graphic designer, and I use that term very, very loosely, okay? I don't think that anybody who is an actual graphic designer would ever use that term to describe me.
You don't think so?
But let me just amend that just to be, you know, full transparency. Graphic designer term. No, just kidding. We need a drum set right there.
Ba-dum-tsh.
Yeah. So anyway, as a person who uses a graphic design program, and I probably shouldn't mention the program because that'll probably get me a lot of hate too. You know, how dare you call yourself a graphic designer and use that program?
Oh, you're using the wrong kind. It's not.
I'm sure I am. No, if whatever the cool program is, I'm sure I'm not using it.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, it's CorelDRAW, right? So I've been with CorelDRAW since like CorelDRAW 5, right?
How dare you use such a program?
CorelDRAW 24 or something like that, right? I don't know. But anyway, they're always changing shit, right? They're always moving buttons around. They're making things do different things. And every couple of years, right, when they update the Corel and everything, it just, every single time I've got to spend, it feels like I have to spend hours relearning where everything is, where the functions are, where I want them, you know, with the things that are supposed to do with and where they live now and so on. So multiply that by the millions of, you know, CorelDRAW users who are experiencing that to some degree and how much time is lost.
Just wasted hours looking for the right button.
Yeah. And that's just because, you know, they don't understand the concept of building habits when you're in workflow.
Oh, it frustrates me to no end when they update QuickBooks and like one thing is off, because I just use it so often that I kind of memorized all the shortcuts. I know everything else. So when they change a little thing, I'm like, what am I looking at? What is happening?
Hey, I was a QuickBooks millionaire like 12 years ago.
There you go.
You know, because I'd hit the wrong button somewhere and it like doubled or tripled our revenue.
Yeah, that happens often, I think. So, but reliability is just so important in business in general. You and I have spitballed 100 times about if we could figure out a good handyman business where the guy would show up sober and do the work properly and for a decent price, we'd be millionaires. But I don't know that we could ever figure it out how to get that done.
Are you having a lot of drunken handyman problems?
Man, I'm telling you what. They come out to my house and it seems like they're going to do the work.
Bar.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I picked the wrong guys.
Check your bar over here and see if it's solid.
You know?
Looks like you're missing a nail under here where your maker's mark is.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they're going to work on that for a little while. Yeah. But not necessarily drunken, but just showing up clean cut and doing the work properly. And it's one of the hardest things in the construction industry, but really it kind of hits all facets of industry, you know, just having a reliable service that you can count on seems like it's harder to find nowadays.
No, it is. It's very hard to find, you know, so I own a home, you know, I say that only because, you know, 10 years ago I didn't own a home.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm 56, so for 46 years or 26 years of my adult life, I didn't own a home, had no chance to buy a home. At least I figured I didn't, right? Mm-hmm. I really didn't. You know, I didn't have enough reliable income, right?
Yeah.
To amass a down payment or qualify for any of the helpful services that were out there.
Yeah.
Or even truly service it, because it's not just the payment on the house that you have to make. You have to pay the insurance, you have to the upkeep, everything else. You can't, you know, because houses are basically subject to entropy, you know, so as soon as the final nail is driven, there's something on the house that needs to be repaired.
We'll see a lot of that with cars. Guys will come in and talk to me about budgets and stuff on like buying a new car and that kind of stuff. And they can well afford the car, but I have to remind them that they can't afford the upkeep, especially on some of these really expensive cars. You know, you have to get different oil changes. You have to go to the guy and it's a fortune. So
why do I feel like you're talking directly to me?
No, that wasn't a you thing. You've never got too crazy about that. But if you buy like a ridiculous house, you might be able to like squeak by paying the mortgage, but you don't think about all the crap that's going to break and you got to pay for it. So it's a good thought on business too. You got to think about, you know, your machines breaking and everything. Those are just upkeep costs that you got to pay attention to.
Well, you know, so for example, right, we have a laser cutter and engraver in our shop. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the parts that we do are laser cut, you know, because we don't, we adjust them for people. So if, you know, someone wants it longer, shorter, whatever, it's easier to do that with a laser than it is to do it with a die cut. So a lot of the parts we do laser cuts, we do laser outlines for different designs and things like that, so our toolers can follow it. So when the laser goes down, right, that takes down almost the entire shop, you know, except for the products that don't need it.
Right.
And the thing is that if you're at capacity like we are, then your customers are expecting you to maintain the same pace, mm-hmm. and so on, right? So right now ours is about 12 to 14 weeks is what we tell them. We are, most of the time, we know that we're going to come in a little bit earlier than that, so we want to give ourselves a little bit of a buffer.
And that's the way to do it. Always under promise.
But, you know, the fact of it is that our people can only make so many cases in a day.
Yeah.
So when we lose a day, we don't get a day back by making twice as many cases the next day, you know, or 10% more cases the next day for the next 10 days, for example. When you're at full capacity already, there's no room for any of that.
And reliability becomes even more important, particularly for your machines and stuff too.
But if I wanted, you know, if we could have them work overtime, for example, not only would it cost us more, they would be more tired, more mistakes would happen, and so on. So, you know, that's where this comes in with not only you as a supplier of goods or supplier of services being reliable and truly, you know, under-promising and over-delivering. And the thing is that if you think about it, you could set this up this way. You know, you can really truly set it up this way, and you could say, how do I want to be treated? I mean, it's the literal golden rule.
Right.
You know, in business, how do I want to be treated, right? Now, there's something I want to say about that too, you know, since we're on this topic of, you know, how do I want to be treated in terms of reliability, right? There's also being true to yourself, right? Being true to the conduct between people, you know? Having manners and being, you know, so what I mean is that you treat people like you would want to be treated, and we're going to assume that you want to be treated well, right? So you're going to treat them well, and then most of the time you're going to receive that back, you know, for that.
Right.
Sometimes you won't, and you can decide to either, you know, diffuse it nicely and politely if possible. Or you can decide to just fire them as a customer and say, I'm sorry, I don't want your business. But the point is that if you yourself are reliable, you know, and true to yourself, then you're never going to have to worry about losing any particular customer.
Yeah.
You know, because you will have built up that trust, and you'll built up that rapport with a broader range of customers who are very quick to take your side. You know, if that problem customer speaks up or, you know, says something negative about you or tries to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, that also means, you know, that you can behave badly sometimes and get away with it because people will take your side. So you should never abuse that. You know, you should never abuse that trust. You should just try to be ethical and honest. That's what we're trying to tell you here, is that you can build a good, solid business, you know. So I like to go deal with people who are reliable, you know. I like to know if they tell me that something's going to be there at a certain time, that it'll be there.
And that's one of the things we really strive for at my business, is to try to be as most reliable as possible. And it's one of the reasons I've probably foolishly since the beginning given most of my clients my cell phone number so they could call me directly, text me directly. That's slowly becoming untenable, but we'll keep it going for as long as we can. But I always try to give them realistic expectations in our services, you know, especially some of these IRS cases. I always way overestimate where we're going to be so that I can be seen as reliable. And And when I say that something's going to be done on this day, I'm going to die trying to make sure it's done. Otherwise, you just lose clients.
Yeah, it's no good. You know, I mean, I've had accountants before that I've gotten another $12,000 tax bill before.
Yeah.
But I'm the one that's giving up the trust, you know, because I don't know. And I'm relying on that person. So then if they prove themselves unreliable with, you know, not filing something on a timely manner or not paying a certain bill if that's what they're contracted to do, or, you know, me ending up with getting letters from the IRS saying that something wasn't done right, you know, I don't have a clue as to whether it was done right or not. So that's why it's so important for a business like yours, you know, because guys like me, we trust you with a lot of information. We also trust you to, you know, keep us honest and tell us, you know, the things that we want to do aren't kosher.
Right.
Because a lot of times we don't know, you know, we think, why not? You know, it's a free country. It should be that way. Maybe it should be, but if it's against the law, it's against the law. So we rely on somebody like you to say, look, dude, I know you want to do that. You should probably be able to do that. But if you do that, it's not legal.
You're going to trouble.
And, you know, that might be a bitter pill to swallow if you're an entrepreneur. But the point is that if you want to build a reliable company and you want to be somebody that other people want to transact with, then you got to play this game the right way, the whole way. You know, there are people that will get away with shit. There are people that will push the envelope. But the business type that we're asking you to build here is a solid, solid income that you can make with your take-home pay. And that's why having that trust, you can earn that money with the trust from a smaller group of customers, you know, than the people who constantly churn through customers because they're making these grandiose promises that their structure just cannot deliver, you know. I hired a salesman first, you know, when I was first with JB Cases. That guy would talk up these cases, you know, to the moon.
Yeah.
Good guy, really good guy, but his salesmanship needed work, right?
Right.
So he was just super enthusiastic, super hype about the cases, you know. But then he would turn around and he'd have that moment after he's got them hooked, right? He's told them all the good stuff about the cases, true stuff, you know, not fake. But just the way he did it was just like, you know, like Bruce Buffer in the ring, you know.
Right.
And he's got these folks hooked, right? He's got them. And the case is a good value, right? So I'm explaining some sales techniques here to you guys, but I don't want to make it sound like, you know, I'm saying that our cases are only easy to sell if they're hyped up, right? It's just that he loved them so much and his style was to really just you know, go over the top talking about them. So he's got them though, right? They got their card out, they're ready to pay. And then he turns around and he gives them a discount, you know, just all by himself. And so I had to sit him down after day one and I had to show him the math. You know, I had to do the thing I talked about in the other segment where I said, how many more of these do you need to sell, you know, to earn the money if you give a discount? These people are, you know, if they buy the case for 20%, then they're a little bit happy. If 20% off, they're a little bit happier. Great, I bought this awesome case, I saved 20%. They would have been just as happy with the case buying it at full price.
Yeah, right? Yeah. People
like they're going to save a little bit, okay, great.
But too quick to offer discounts to try to close the sale.
Yeah, and so after I talked to him about selling the quality and stopping there and just letting people mull it over and think about it, right? Don't mistake any hesitation on their part for refusal, right? Or for, you know, deciding against purchasing it.
Right.
Just have faith, you know, that you've done everything you can to explain it, show it. You know it's quality, right? You already know that it's real quality. You're not having to lie about it to sell it. Then just let them think about it, man. And you're going to get some customers. You're going to lose some customers. It's all right. You've given them the information. Worst thing they can ever do is go tell somebody else about how great the case was that they decided not to buy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So the way to be reliable, you know, as we're talking about it, in my opinion, right, is to remember why you're doing it, why you're doing whatever it is you're doing, right? Because if it's to give a service, then giving the best service that you can, you know, and staying up to speed on what the field is, you know. Something we're going to talk about in a minute is like the extra IRS agents and stuff. Which, you know, this will tie in a moment, right, for that, because they'll see what we're talking about. But it's the, what was that? Where was I at with that? Help me out.
I got no idea, man. I got lost myself. So you're going to have to find your own place in the conversation.
No, it was about being reliable. It was about like making sure that your product and your service is spot on.
Oh yeah.
So it's
yeah.
unassailable practically, yeah. You know? And then your salesmen don't have to lie, or they don't have to give discounts, or they don't have to put on any kind of sliminess whatsoever to try to pressure the customer into a sale. So the customer walks away from that transaction feeling like they got actual value, that the thing that they purchased from you, the service or the good, is actually a reliable thing they can count on.
Yeah,
that's what I think of when I think of this topic of reliability as pertains to business.
That's a very good point. One of the unreliable things in my mind that always kind of pops out is the kind of common meme of McDonald's McFlurry machine always being broken down, and they had some kind of goofy contract deal, but where they had to have some service people come fix it. But it seemed like every time I ever went there and wanted a McFlurry, it was broken or I couldn't get one.
Oh, it's a running joke in my house now.
Right.
You know.
And that's not something that your business wants to become known for. I mean, it would be exciting if you were as big as McDonald's and known so well, but those little things can really turn people off of a company entirely. What are some companies that you like that you feel like have real reliable service or a real reliable product that you?
Oh, well, my go-to on that is always going to be Uline.
Uline?
Yeah, if you go to their website, if you're a Uline customer and you go to their website, if you can't like get in and out with your order in like 10 minutes, then that's just because when you're 90, you're going to be a mall walker.
Yeah.
You know? You just like seeing the same thing over and over again and just, you know, window shopping endlessly, because Uline has made their website so good that you can find anything from their search bar. You can find it in any manner of number of ways. Once you're their customer, you've got a full history of all your orders. You can order anything from any past order. You know, it'll take you straight to it and put it on your new order. I mean, their whole structure is for what they do and what they sell. They sell boxes and they sell shipping supplies, and then they've got some cleaning supplies, stuff like, basically, you know, industrial supplies. For what they do and for what I imagine is the amount of people who actually use them in, you know, larger companies than us,
mm-hmm.
they have, if you order a pallet or two of stuff, that pallet is showing up, you know, at 9 o'clock in the morning. The next day, the guy's calling you up.
On time, every time.
If there's any communication problems, we've had like a couple few problems. They just clear it up immediately. No big deal. They send us new boxes, whatever it is.
Yeah.
That company is a model of reliability in my opinion. So yeah, they come down the immediate go-to.
That's a good example. I think if I had to highlight one, is one of my kind of favorite places for lunch is Kava now. I don't know if you've ever been there. It's kind of a little fast, casual Mediterranean food, but every time I go, the food is just spot on. It's exactly what I wanted. It's consistent and really good. And a lot of places, especially food places, can kind of fail on the consistency. You know, a lot of times people will talk about different locations being better or worse, and that's always kind of a disaster in the reliability field that we're talking about, you know. So that's one of my favorite go-tos, though. I eat lunch there quite a bit. So
yeah, I'll have to try that place. I hadn't heard about it.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
But yeah, I mean, it's when you can go in a place and the service and everything just blends well and you feel comfortable there,
mm-hmm.
then yes, that is going to become in your mind a comfort spot, you know, a safe spot, if you will. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to use that word right now.
You know? Safe place. I think safe you're fine. Place,
yeah. But it really, any place that in your mind becomes a place where you can just relax, just let things go and not worry too much about whatever else is going on in the world at that moment, that's a safe place for you. So,
yep.
So if you're a restaurateur and you really think about it from that perspective, rather than how fast can I turn the tables, people pretty much eat and think, you know, about the same pace, I think. So I think there's probably a comfortable average there, you know, even in a place that is, you know, you don't necessarily want to get up and leave.
You know, I don't know enough about it. We'd have to get a restaurateur in here.
That right, might right, be a good right. I think that would be a good idea. But I think that there's probably an industry, you know, study on that.
I'm sure there is. Many of them. Yeah. And depending on what kind of food, probably people eat faster or slower. But yeah.
But the point is, though, is that if you develop a place like that where you feel really good about being there, then when the question comes up of where are we going to eat, right? That's going to be one of your, you know, top 3-4 go-tos that you're going to rotate through.
100%. I think that's where reliability really comes in, is that if you are a reliable company, then people are happy spending their money at your facility. Exactly. And if you can make a customer happy about giving you their money, then you've got a home run of a business.
Yeah, not only are they happy, they're happy to tell everyone too.
And they'll come back and again and again. Yeah. So
that's why reliability is so important, you know, and it's why that when you're in business, you have to think about all your different stakeholders that we talked about before. You have your
customers, your vendors, employees, and suppliers.
Right. And your lenders, right?
Mm-hmm. Lenders. I'm sorry. Lenders, I think I said vendors bankers, and suppliers, but yeah, lenders.
So, you know, these are all the people that are involved with whatever it is you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the people a lot of times who bought into the passion that you were sharing with them. But it's also one of the reasons why when a lot of ventures fail sometimes that started out kind of inauthentic but had a good story, that people say, oh, he sold me a bill of goods or he sold me a fantasy. You know, he sold me, right?
Right.
In the beginning, though, you know, for the entrepreneur, it's like you're sharing some part of yourself with them. You're saying, this is what I really, really want to do.
Yeah.
You know, I was born to do this. You know, the stars were aligned. So if you're really interested in building that business, you know, that other people are happy to tell their friends and vouch for that it can be counted on, then this is the way you go about it. You know, you be true to yourself and you literally try as much as you can without debasing yourself. That's very important. You know, I feel like I have to say that.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, they start to think, oh, that means I have to do anything for the customer. Right?
No.
And no, that's not what we mean. You're trading the customer, your good or your service, for their money.
Right.
That's the transaction. So they're giving you their money, which you can spend any way you want, wherever you want. You know, that's the whole point of the money. And what they expect in return from you is a good that's worth that money. So your responsibility, just as a person, if you really want to build something solid, is from the very first thing that you do with a customer, you are giving them more value than they expect. You work out how to do that, and you really are a good person, ethical person, truthful person.
Reliable person.
Then you will be seen as a reliable and a trustworthy person.
Oh, there you go. Any thoughts, final thoughts on reliability?
Dude, it takes me a while to get there sometimes, but it's coming down the road.
I believe you. I believe you.
The gravity's working from here to here.
I believe you. I was just trying to throw in. I just try to get a word in edgewise every once in a while, you know?
I'm pacing right now. Poor Scott. He's been sitting there listening to me. He's watching me think.
I'm trying to, like, get in every once in a while. So.
Sorry about that.
No worries, man.
All right. So, no, I don't have any more thoughts on that, you know? I'm...
Fair enough. Well, try to be.
I've said everything.
Try to be reliable. This podcast is brought to you by S&H Business Services. We are serving the OKC and greater Oklahoma area. We offer tax preparation, accounting, bookkeeping, and payroll services for small businesses and individuals. You can find us at shbusinessservices.com. Again, that's S&H Business Services, found at shbusinessservices.com. Next segment, we're going to try a new one. We're just going to talk about what doesn't affect you.
So I like this one.
Here we can maybe get up on our soapbox a little bit. Too often, people will shout and holler about things in the news or the media that are, you know, it's going to ruin their lives. It's going to destroy their businesses. It's going to take all their money. It's going to destroy them as a person. And I would say that the vast majority of the time, it does not affect you.
I totally agree, man. This is what I try to tell people all the time. I'm like, dude, I've known you for 10 years. You're doing the same thing you were 10 years ago, and that was three presidents ago.
So one of the ones that we're going to talk about today, and one that I have heard in my office about every day for the past 6 months since they've announced it, is the IRS is hiring a ludicrous amount of new agents, and they're going to increase their audit capacity, and everybody is freaking out that their personal taxes are going to be audited and they're going to owe a bunch of money and go to jail. And the truth of the matter is that while audits are increasing, it mostly doesn't affect the average American or the average small business owner. And so I don't know if we have some stats popping up, but I think in this article, it says 20,000 new IRS agents. I've read a couple different articles, but the majority of the employee, these new people are going to focus on partnerships and corporations over $10 million. And some of the percentages that I read is something around 0.5% or less than 1% of partnerships over $10 million are currently being audited every year. They're going to increase that number to about 1.3%. So it's a big jump when you think about the number of companies. You know, that's probably several more thousand a year. But not very many people in my office have partnerships with assets over $10 million.
Yeah. So basically what we're saying is that for most of you out there, this doesn't affect you.
Yeah. And I think the total number that they're trying to hire is something like 87,000 new agents. Even at that capacity, you know, with 300 million Americans and all of the different business, and not to mention the complexity of doing an actual audit, your personal taxes on your W-2 or your small business, unless you're just making up wild numbers, is very unlikely to get audited.
Right. So they would have to take basically the percentage of audits that come in and figure out that of those, a certain percentage of people would probably be fudging their numbers and owe more tax than they stated. Mm-hmm. Then they would have to go and do a complete audit on all of those returns, which may or may not show that percentage of cheating. But at the end of the day, when they've done all these audits and everything, what have they actually recovered? You know, that, you know, say it's somebody that owes $150,000 and he owes $250,000 instead.
Right.
You know, at the end of the day, when you add all that up, that they maybe recover, and all the effort that was put into it, why not just go after the very, very wealthy, the very, you know, very wealthy corporations that are using every possible loophole that exists to lower their tax bill.
Well, and that is the aim of this new initiative, is to go after larger companies. Like I said, most of these, the article I read anyway said that most of the audits are going to increase on partnerships and corporations over the $10 million value, which is kind of a benchmark for going from a smaller company to a larger company. And so they're going to be auditing these bigger companies, which takes more manpower and more work, and trying to get those ones that are cheating, like you're talking about. But the average small business owner who's doing, you know, maybe a couple million in sales, taking home a few hundred thousand dollars, the guy who's working a W-2 job, you know, or maybe even a 1099 and has a few expenses, they're not in any worry.
And people don't understand the magnitude of scale, right? Just like you just said right there. So, for example, the article we're looking at here says They had 79,000 employees before they started hiring more people from the funding. They can hire up to 87,000, right? So
I think they're going to do 87,000 more. So they're going to attempt to double the size, but that's not for
this year.
It's going to be over the next 10 years.
Right. And it's phased in over 10 years. But every single year, annually, how many returns are put in?
Oh, yeah. Well, there should be, you know, several hundred million personal returns, you know, at least everybody over the age of 18.
How many millions of corporate
lots of business and corporations. So I don't actually know the number off the top of my head, but it's in the hundreds of millions.
Yeah, so you guys can just do the numbers. Just divide it, you know, several hundred million by 150,000 agents.
Well,
you know, and not all those agents are doing audits anyway.
Correct. And then also the IRS has some percentage methods and computer analysis that they use to discover inaccuracies in certain industries.
Sure.
And so really, if your numbers are accurate and you're doing good books, you don't need to worry. If you're cheating and you're hoping that you're going to be able to continue to get away with things, I would say maybe invest in an accountant. But for the most part, especially people who are just working W-2 jobs and taking the regular credits there's no worries there.
Hold on a second. We got to clear something up real quick, okay? So if you're cheating, Scott said invest in an accountant, okay? You invest in an accountant so the accountant can tell you to stop cheating and how to do it correctly, so that you're legal from that moment on.
Yeah, not how to cheat correctly, but how to do your taxes correctly.
But people make that assumption that accountants know how to cheat like a locksmith knows how to pick a lock. And they probably do. But they like to stay out of jail too. So.
Well, I mean, we would lose all of our licenses
exactly.
And stuff if we knew that we were cheating. What does that say? Oh, yeah. So at the same time that they're hiring 87,000 new employees, the IRS is estimating that they're going to lose 52,000 from retirement. So the net change in how many they're actually going to have is going to not be that
30,000?
Much. 30,000? And again, it's not going to affect the average consumer. These are for businesses and corporations whose taxes are very complicated that now the IRS will be able to take a better look at, which is a good thing for the economy because they will be able to discover some inaccuracies and find people that may or may not be cheating or may have just accidentally underreported and hopefully have a better revenue stream and everybody will be paying their fair share.
I read something about this, I want to say a year or two ago on some economics website, but it was sort of an estimate, if I remember correctly, of how many companies of certain sizes will just simply not file a return. And they're like, and you can please correct me if I've got this wrong on here, because I'm probably getting something wrong. But is there like a sort of a statute of limitations? Like if you don't pay for 10 years, then they, like the 10th year drops off and then it.
So when we have clients that come in, and we've had clients that come in that have not filed taxes in over a decade, the longest person that ever came here was 20 years that we had to catch up on. We only filed the most recent 7. So 7 years is how far we have to go back for the IRS. And that is generally acceptable to the IRS. If they have, and that's 7 years from the due date, so April 15th, the original unextended due date. They do have the ability to go back further, especially if they've filed what are called substitute returns. The substitute returns is if, you know, you have 1099s and stuff, they'll just file a return for you with no expenses. And then that extends the time a little bit that they can come after you.
Oh, but, so they file it on your behalf.
Uh-huh,
so
they'll file a tax return.
So under the law, they're saying they're substituting themselves as you.
Mm-hmm. Well, they don't substitute themselves. The IRS keeps track of all W-2s and 1099s and tax forms submitted. Whether, you know, when you do a W-2, we submit everything to the Social Security Administration and then you give a copy to the employee. The IRS has records of all that. So they'll just file a tax return on your behalf. So they have – typically, though, we have to go back 7 years if they haven't done any of that. They also have 3 years to audit any financial or any tax return unless they find substantial underreporting or substantial mistakes, then they can go up to 7 years. So we always tell people to keep stuff for at least 3 years, ideally 7 years. You should keep all your documents.
So basically, I think what I'm saying is that there's people who are probably playing a game where –
That is absolutely
the case. They're trying to outweigh the IRS and hope that they don't get caught up with.
I have some clients that do that because the statute on things falling off is usually about the 10 years that you had mentioned before. So the tax return, if you owe taxes, like say you owe $100,000 for 2024 taxes, if you wait until 2035, when the 10 years from when it was due, you filed your taxes, you just never paid them, those numbers actually do fall off.
So let me ask you this then. Can the IRS come to you if you haven't filed your taxes in a certain year? Can they come? Can they just come to you and say, hey, we noticed you didn't file your taxes. Mm-hmm. We need your return.
They'll send you letters. They'll send you stuff. And if they file a substitute return on your behalf saying this is how much we think you owe, which is always way more than you actually owe, they can do two things. They can levy and they can lien. So liens are when they put liens against your property, just like you've probably heard of construction lien and stuff like that. A levy, the IRS is allowed to go into your personal bank account and just take your money.
So there you go, folks. They'll That's why it's important it. To not play these games and do it the right way.
100%, yeah. And I always recommend, unless you're just a regular W-2 employee and can very easily file on TurboTax, I recommend putting the money aside for an accountant. We can almost always do better than you can do yourself on your business returns and taxes, and we can always make sure things are filed properly.
Well, there you go. So, you know, that... That turned into a little bit of an advertisement for hiring a good accountant.
Yeah.
But the fact of it is that, you know, part of what we're doing here is we're trying to help you to understand why that professionals in the fields can, you know, can really help you as an entrepreneur. Because there are things that, you know, if you're anything like me, you'll think to yourself, it can't be that hard. You know?
Well, it really shouldn't be, but it sure turns out to be.
Well, you know, maybe it shouldn't be. But as long as it is, right, as long as there are so many rules and regulations and things that you have to put on your forms and you have to account for and things that you could take a deduction for but you don't know about or whatever, you know, or ways that things can be structured, then you're really giving – you're essentially giving away a lot of your earnings – by not knowing these things, because the people that are way above us, they realize that if they invest a couple million, you know, they can save tens of millions or sometimes hundreds of millions. You know what I mean? So they don't care if they pay very high priced accountants, because there's a balance there on what those accountants cost versus what they save.
Yeah, absolutely.
But at our level, you know, we don't know about these things because we think to ourselves, how hard can it be? And we don't go and find the professionals that can really take care of it and keep us on the right, not only keep us on the right track and keep us on the right side of the law, but they can also help us to realize that when we do have a surplus, now we need to invest it. Now we need to let it work, you know, because the government, they're going to take everything they can, you know, everything that you put on your return at the end of it, when you get down to the bottom and it says taxable income, they're going to figure a rate off that and they're going to take money.
Yeah.
So the way to reduce your taxable income is to have somebody who knows what they're doing to help you invest it. You know, this is going to get a tiny little bit political real quick, but the highest rate of growth that we had in this country was when we had a 90% tax rate. And the only reason for that, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but the only reason for that, as I understand it, was that it was an incentive for companies to invest their money before they spend it on taxes.
It is. It was an incentive for the individual as well to spend all their money. My great-grandfather was alive during that time, during the oil boom. And so he actually was at that tax rate, but they all made sure to spend all of their money beforehand. Nobody in their right mind actually paid 90%.
Right.
They kept what was at a reasonable tax rate and then spent the rest. So. But anyway, we kind of did get off on a little tangent there. Back to the original point, these new hirings of IRS agents, it will not affect you as a person, as an individual or a small business owner. Big corporations should be paying attention, but the average person doesn't affect them at all.
So, you know, that's what we want you to take away is don't be worried about this nonsense a lot of the time. They want to make it seem like you're going to be the one that's going to be affected and it's going to kill you and your business is going to go under and, you know, this side or the other side is anti-business because they're doing this or that. But when you really sit down and you start to think about it and do a little bit of research – just, you know, keep an open mind. It doesn't mean that you have to trust or distrust any particular source, but you can read the story. And, you know, if you're got a halfway decent functioning brain, you know, then you should be able to discern what sounds plausible and what doesn't.
Well, I think that's the big problem is people just don't read the full story. They just read the headline.
Yeah.
And then they hear the headline on the news, or they hear it in a TikTok, or they hear it in a very short deal. Kind of like we talked about last time, idioms, like, you know, customers always right. They always get shortened. And so you hear these just little snippets of doom and gloom without really looking into it. And as a business owner, like we talked about, you've got to look into things.
Yeah, you got to look into it. But one more thing is, and this just comes straight from my heart and from experience, right? And you've seen it. I mean, you can start getting hung up on shit as a business owner, wanting your voice to be heard, wanting to be out there, wanting to give your opinion, and you'll lose 3 hours. You'll lose 5 hours. You know, you'll be arguing with some dipshits on the internet somewhere, you know, trying to convince them that you're right because you've got 30 years of business experience, you know, and you put out payroll for X number of people or whatever, you know, and you just they just have to understand that you're right. You know, what else could you be doing in those 5 hours that would be more productive for your life? You know what I mean?
You're talking about yourself.
Of course, I'm talking about myself, but I'm talking about a lot of people because the people who are truly, you know, out there putting out this angertainment stuff about these 87,000 IRS agents, they are basically fucking with the minds of the people who worry about this kind of stuff.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
They are deliberately making these people upset.
Fear is a business.
Exactly. It's a business, you know? And when it's a business and they're not charging you any money, what they're charging you is time.
Yeah.
You know? And they're using that time to burrow into your head and keep you from paying attention to the things that you need to pay attention to that are not only going to make you more money, because you're not getting that 5 hours back. You know, whatever else you could have been doing in that 5 hours, making phone calls, calling clients, building something, whatever it is, you're not getting it back. It's gone. Could have made your kid happy. You could have done a million things that would after that 5 hours, you would feel great, whatever any of those million things were. But the one thing that you can do that you're guaranteed to feel like shit is spend 5 hours arguing with dipshits on the internet over things that don't affect you.
Absolutely.
So,
well put, man. Well put. Any other thoughts on the "it doesn't affect you" segment?
Hope I can follow my own advice, folks.
I hope so too. Well, it was good talking to you again, man. Check us out on turtlesmith.com. We'll see you next week.
All right. Y'all take care. Bye-bye.